Is Major Belt still part of your orbit? Wayne Belt.
Thank you.
He's in the NITT.
All right, everyone.
Yes, he's in the
inside framework.
Yeah, I checked with Bob.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm John Fitzpatrick. I'm the Director of the Information Security Oversight Office. Happy to welcome everyone here to the 8th SLTPS PAC meeting, the second one for the year, the last one that we'll have in calendar 2014. As everyone knows, this is a public meeting convened under the Federal Advisory Committee Act. We record these meetings, we take minutes from these meetings, and we make those minutes available to the public. We have a good agenda, briefings, a lot of information coming our way from DHS today. And so we want to make sure that we have a good exchange of information. We also have our continuing budgetary challenges, and so we have a good number of folks that are dialing in, we want to give an opportunity for those folks to identify themselves. We are now, we have a new technological hookup so that the folks can hear through the microphones what's going, folks on the telephone are running through the mixing board, not just hearing ambient room through the room noise through the phone. And so, and will we hear them? Julie, will we hear them through the speakers? Okay, terrific. So let me first ask the folks, well, I want to introduce two new folks, and they're both on the phone, and then we'll ask everyone else on the phone to introduce themselves. We have new members to the committee. The first new member is Jeff Friedland. He's the director of the St. Clair County, Michigan Homeland Security and Emergency Management Operation. So welcome, Jeff.
And, Good morning, John. And
we also have Chris Pickering. He's the Homeland Security Advisor Coordinator for the Missouri, if I say that right, Missouri Department of Public Safety. Chris, are you there?
Good morning, everyone.
Okay, terrific. Other folks on the phone, I'm going to read off names, and if you're there, please say aye and say hello. We've got William Pelgrin.
Aye, and hello, everyone.
Great, welcome. James Webb.
Yeah, Dewey Webb here. I'm with the National Native American Law Enforcement Association.
Welcome, Dewey. Ben Linegang.
Yes, present.
Terrific. And Glenn Bensley.
Hello, everyone.
All right, great. Also by teleconference, I think we've got Lieutenant Phillips.
Good morning, everyone.
Great. And then from OPM, we should have Bruce Hunt and Trish Krasnikar.
Good morning.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Let's let you know who is in the room today. I introduce myself to my client.
Clyde Miller. I'm the vice chair for the private sector and state and local tribal organization or element of it. I'm currently the Director of Security for Southern California Edison in Southern California.
And we're grateful that you were able to join us in person today, so thank you, on your own.
Leo Masiana, Office of Information Security, U.S. Department of State.
And Karen Herndon from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Office of the National Counterintelligence Agency.
Okay.
Carmen West with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Kim Knight with the Department of Transportation, Office of Security, sitting in for Lewandowski.
Welcome.
Ken Saab with the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis, State Local Programs.
Bob
Scrapp
with ISU.
Omar Navarro, ISU.
Book of Land Defense Security Service.
Lori Latham, FBI, sitting in for Elaine Cummings.
Mark Brooks, Department of Energy, sitting in for Dr. Donovan.
Tim Davis, Department of Defense.
Joe Hammer, Director of Information Management for CIA.
Greg Pannoni, ISU, and as this is a federal advisory committee, I'm the designated federal official.
Charlie Rogers. I'm with the DHS Office of Security and the State and Local Management Security Management Division.
Okay. Right here, so with Security Management Division.
James
Cornwell, Security Management Division, DHS.
Terrific.
Elena Clark, DHS, Intergovernmental Affairs.
Welcome.
Eric Walters, I see.
Okay.
I'm Marcia Bird from the Department of Justice, Office of Tribal Justice.
Terrific. Welcome. And I just heard a beep on the phone. Did someone just join? Okay, maybe not. All right, so let me turn it over to Greg. He'll review old business and actions from the last meeting.
Good morning, and thank you. As we heard, we're still under budgetary constraints, so we have the teleconference capability, and we thank everyone for their cooperation on that. But I do want to thank SLTPS Vice Chair for his attendance on essentially his own dime, as there are no funds. Also want to thank all the federal government members for submitting their updated information on financial disclosure, which is a requirement to ensure there's no conflicts of interest while serving as an SLTPS federal member. Now to the four action items from the last meeting. DHS will report on the first three, and they concern the identification of metrics for evaluating the effectiveness of information sharing, and also the impacts of security barriers to information sharing. And the third one has to do with creating a document for newly appointed security liaisons to help them with their responsibilities in that capacity. The last item was for the PAC staff, the SLT PAC staff, to arrange for a briefing from the Interagency Threat Analysis and Coordination Group. The ITAC, as you may know, has been replaced by the urban environment, right? So, by the Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team, the JCAT. And so while we haven't arranged for that briefing yet, we hope to do so for the next meeting. The JCAT consists, as you may know, of state, local, tribal, territorial first responders and public safety personnel, federal intelligence analysts from the National Counterterrorism Center, DHS and FBI, and together they research and produce and disseminate counterterrorism intelligence. So we hope to hear from them at our next meeting. And so are there any questions?
All right. Thanks,
back
Greg.
To you, Mr. Chair.
We turn it over to Charlie Rogers, who's got a slate of things to review for us.
Yeah. I'm going to go over the action items that Greg mentioned. And the first one was the, probably won't use the same terminology as Greg, but the interest in information sharing metrics and how we're tracking the movement of information between fusion centers and the federal government. And that's really why Kevin Stout is here today. He's with the State and Local Program Office. He's very much involved with the management of the fusion centers and tracking all the interactions, both what DHS is doing and the federal government is doing. So he's going to give a briefing, a broad overview of the fusion center program, and he's let it be known that he's willing to answer questions on the information sharing aspects of what they're doing and how they're tracking it. So that addresses the first action item. The second one was kind of a request for us to try and determine a method or a mechanism by which we can see whether or not our security processes and procedures are having an impact on information sharing. So what we've done thus far is when we go out on these security compliance reviews, and we are at the point now where by the end of the year we will have done about 41. But when we go out, we have a general questionnaire that we ask of as many cleared personnel as we can get our hands on. And that questionnaire in the past has been really focused on their knowledge of security forms, their knowledge of how to report a security violation. It's about 20 questions, and it's very much trying to gauge their understanding and knowledge of security, and that's what its purpose was. Well, what we've done is we've added two questions to the compliance review, or actually it's a question and a follow-up to the compliance review questionnaire. And the The first question is to ask them whether any security policies, procedures, or any of the processes that they're required to do under the security program are having, do they know of any adverse impact that these processes or procedures are having to information sharing? The follow-up question is then, if there are any, we want to know in specific detail what they are. It's not just a yes and go on to the next. So we've just recently implemented the questionnaire. It's, as I said, it's asked of about, generally we're getting about a half a dozen or eight people interviewed. It's now required that the security liaison who works at the Fusion Center answer that question. You know, typically he's interviewed separately, but we want to make sure that he's asked that particular question. And the idea is once we start getting responses back that we're going to follow up with phone calls to people and say, look, we have an indication and then we'll be able to report in the future what we found out from this. I can't say what I don't know. I don't feel that our procedures are having that negative an impact. I mean, we all operate under a security environment when we're dealing with classified information. But nonetheless, we're going to implement this questionnaire and follow up and collect the data, and we can bring it back and let the group know if there's a particular process or policy that seems to be adversely affecting them.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really important step to take, and the idea of getting some performance measure, usually when you try some performance measure, you get that data, it tells you what the next sort of data is to collect, and so it's a crawl, walk, run kind of a thing. And there's also, in this kind of environment, and this room is full of security folks and information folks, and so it's not uncommon for the perception of procedural barriers to actually inform people's idea that they're being, that information is not getting to them. And you want to be able to address that through hard metrics and then what I call a feels-like metric. So it sounds like you're going to get a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. And that really can, you know, help you learn what are the things that people are, when you get a response like, you know, I think I'm not getting this kind of stuff. Then you can actually investigate that and either, you know, change that perception or add, discover new kinds of transactions to measure. So I appreciate the effort in getting at that, because it is a tough nut to crack.
I think the last action item had to do with, and I'm not sure who kind of brought it up, but the need, or had we considered coming up with a transitional document or a checklist to assist the security liaisons to pass their duties on to an incoming security liaison. And there has been a significant turnover in security liaisons since the inception of the program, although the turnover is getting less and less, and we're getting a larger number of security liaisons that are staying for a longer amount of time. So during the last meeting, Lindsay Johnson mentioned that she had a plan, and she provided us an outline of what she had done. We've worked with the security group that we work with intelligence and analysis, with Ken Polks and his folks, because they have, there's the Office of Security has a role to play in all this, and then Ken and his folks work directly with INA and do a lot of care and feeding at the Fusion Center. So we've come up with a draft document, and Ken did a lot of work on drafting it. We utilized Lindsay's outline. And it's now in the process. Ken's sending it out to several security liaisons to see if it's going to be a helpful document. It's fairly simple. We're trying to keep it down to about 3 pages. The first part is kind of a laundry list or an assignment to the incumbent security liaison to identify certain key files, to create a presentation or a detail of where their passwords are located, where the combinations are located, where the various security containers are located. They probably have this information, but this checklist will kind of direct them to more formally organize it. And then the second half of the checklist is directed to the incoming incumbent to remind him of things, or him or her, of things like, have you gotten an account with CVS? Did you get an HSDN account? Have you collected the passwords, the alarm passwords, and those kind of things? So it's a fairly simple document. It's been drafted. It's being sent to the security liaisons to see, to get a little feedback from them to see if this is something, you know, if there's something we missed or left out. And I think the final part is just a reference to critical, not so much files, but reference material that they need to know where it is or to have access or have their hands on. Different federal, national, and local policies that govern security. So that's where we are with the checklist. So we should have a document shortly.
That last piece sounds good, and I don't know if it could be amplified or even needs to be, but to kind of have a training resource piece to it as well as a reference to federal policies that
right, and they have to get a HISN account, whether we have, I'll talk a little more about HISN, but there's a lot of federal documents up there. They're also, we require the incoming person to conduct a self-inspection, a security self-inspection when they take over the duty. Mm-hmm. So I think there is reference to training, but we can look at it. It's still a work in progress. So that's it.
All right, great. Comments or questions on that? Okay. So next I'd like to ask our OPM partners to who are joining us virtually. Bruce, I think you're going to walk us through updates on CVS as it's supporting. That's the Central Verification System for Security Clearances and Investigations for supporting the SL2 TPS program. Bruce?
Yes, sir. My name is Bruce Hunt. I'm the Chief of the Business Core Systems Branch. The Central Verification System is one of the systems that my branch and my teams support, and our branch helps to develop these requirements. Our current update as far as where we're at with the SLTPS project, we have those requirements identified, and we've passed those to our Chief Information Officer. Currently we're working with them on analysis of several projects that we have currently underway. In the next 30 to 45 days, we hope to be able to publish a milestone schedule with regards to SLTPS. We're currently re-baselining a number of our IT initiatives within OPM, including several that are underway with CVS. Again, we hope to solidify a schedule within the next 30 to 45 days. We're having several meetings with our CIO this week with regards to these projects that we have underway. That milestone schedule published with hopefully some calendar year 14. And that's kind of where we're at with the SLTPS initiative. Again, we hope to publish something in the next 30 to 40 days with regards to milestones.
Okay, Bruce, just to let you know, we're having a little challenge hearing you, so I'm going to recap what I think I heard, and then you can let us know. If I understand it, you have a specific set of requirements for updates to CVS that are responsive to the membership or stakeholders in the SLTPS community, and that working through your CIO's office, those changes are in for the IT development, sort of ordinary IT development schedule with the CIO, and you would expect to have in the next 2 months a better idea of what the schedule for rollout of those new capabilities would be. Did I get that right?
Yes, sir. You're correct. We're currently coordinating with our CIO a number of system changes, and we're hoping to be able to publish a milestone schedule in the next 30 to 45 days.
Okay. So I think it'd be helpful when that's available, if you would make that information available with, you know, just a short blurb that we can publish out to the stakeholders for this meeting. And you can do that in coordination with, you know, Charlie or the regular person from the DHS security team and Bob Skorat on our team, just so we can make sure we can disseminate that information. Because this meeting, this group only convenes twice a year, I think it's important for us to be able to push out meaningful updates like that so people can keep track. So understand that, you know, schedules are in flux, but as soon as, you know, as soon as that kind of information is available, if we can make that available through an email push, that'd be great from our end.
Yes, sir. We'll absolutely get that for you as soon as we have it available to us.
Okay, terrific. Is that it from OPM?
Trish, do you have anything that you needed to add, or?
No, that sounds great. And yeah, we can work on updating the stakeholders at the next meeting. So thanks, everybody.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. All right, next up, I'd like to introduce Kevin Salk. He's from the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis, and he's going to talk to us, walk us through a briefing, and I believe we have for slides in the room and hard copy slides. Did we make these slides available to the folks who are dialing in?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the folks, we're going to switch to a briefing that's entitled Support for the National Network of Fusion Centers. Kevin, if I could ask you, as we go through, to just every once in a while recite a page number so folks dialing in can keep track. So over to you. And maybe we could ask you to slide over so that you're proximate to a microphone and the folks online get the best. Thank you very
much. Great. Can everybody hear me?
All right. Sounds good.
So the briefing that we'll provide here is pretty broad. I want to make sure to cover enough of the background and history so that folks have the context of where we got have come now, as well as to get in some of the specifics of some of the initiatives that we're currently undertaking. It was great to hear some of the performance metrics discussions, so I'll certainly touch on those and how we've incorporated a lot of the work that you all have been discussing here already today into the assessment process and how we essentially refine and provide support to the national network. So I do apologize if any of this is basic. Some folks are familiar with it, but certainly please ask any questions. I want to make sure that we walk away from this having addressed all the questions you might have. So that's the number one priority. So the first slide, the very basic is the Fusion Center overview. I would like to level set with folks and remind folks that the Fusion Centers are owned and operated by the state and local entities. You know, oftentimes we hear the terms DHS Fusion Centers or Federal Fusion Centers thrown out, and we cringe when we hear that because they are owned and operated and have unique authorities under our state and local partners. And the reality is, following 9/11 and that kind of post 9/11 environment, it is very difficult for the federal government to engage with 18,000 law enforcement agencies and to have a reasonable expectation that those agencies are going to be able to handle, store, share, analyze information and intelligence in a manner that we would want to expect or hold them to. And so the growth of the Fusion Centers was really that maturement from a grassroots level. And, you know, we really embraced the concept that the states were much more forward-leaning on because we have a structure in place where we can deal and work with, you know, right now 78 Fusion Centers vice 18,000 individual agencies. It makes it a lot easier to have that increased level of expectation with respect to security issues, privacy issues, analytic standards and competencies of analysts and so forth. And so that, you know, from that perspective, it was a very beneficial engagement and partnership with the federal government. And I think as folks are well aware, the Fusion Centers really serve as that conduit within their jurisdiction for managing that flow of information and meeting the needs of their customers. And their customers in some cases are the federal government. In some cases, it is the state, local, tribal, and private sector partners within their AOR. And so that range is based on the jurisdiction. Next slide, slide three. So this basically recaps a little bit what I just said, but what is a fusion center? It's focused on the fusion process. They are focused on the intelligence cycle and implementing that process within their jurisdiction based on the requirements of their jurisdiction. It may range a variety of different threats, hazards, to include homeland security or national security issues, including terrorism. But the point is that they are flexible based on the requirements of their jurisdiction. And their focus is not duplicating or replicating what occurs at a national level or from the feds. It's to provide local context. They are there to provide a local overlay. So what does this national level information or intelligence mean to the constituents there in their jurisdiction and their stakeholders? A fusion center is not an investigative task force. I can't tell you how many times I've answered the question of what's the difference between a fusion center and a JTTF. It is not investigative, and it is not solely focused on terrorism. And that's some messaging that we continually push to make sure folks understand that clear difference. They are not owned by the federal government. As I stated earlier, there's a lot of misperceptions that we own and operate these entities. And they also are not a base for domestic spying. You often hear blogs or articles that talk about the fusion centers doing this. The reality is the standards that we hold fusion centers to through a variety of means, whether it's federal grant funds or others, we've actually increased the bar. And they are operating at a much higher level of transparency than, say, an individual police department because we've increased the level of expectation from them. Next slide. So the basic background of how fusion centers came to be, and I won't go through this in too much detail, but there has been a series of doctrine dating back to 2003 that has really called for an increase of information sharing capabilities within the state and local environment. And these have really built on one another. And the core document I want to point to is the fourth one over, which is the baseline capabilities document. That is really, I think, the pivotal point that we looked at in really defining what are the capabilities that a fusion center should have, what are the expectations that they should be operating against. And that has really laid the foundation for where the federal government has then picked up managing programs to support them achieving those capabilities. So next slide. Slide five. The fusion center, there's two important policies that I also want to touch on before we jump into some of the specifics of where we're at right now. And building on the policies and the doctrine that I just mentioned, there were two policies that were issued by the federal government, and I use policy in a loose term, but they really have formed the basis for how we've engaged with the network. The first is a letter that came out jointly from DHS and DOJ asking the governors to designate the fusion centers. And that is really where that line in the sand was drawn, that these are state and locally owned and operated entities, and that the federal government is going to recognize what the states tell us. And so that letter came out in 2007 and basically asked those governors to designate and let the federal government know which entities within their states were indeed fusion centers. That also helped us with what I sometimes call the mom-and-pop fusion center effort. A lot of folks are chasing grant funds, and they think that there's money associated with a fusion center. And it's certainly not in our interest to see a quote-unquote fusion center stand up in every local county or local jurisdiction across the country. That's not realistic. That doesn't address some of the issues and challenges that are at hand. And so this really helped us solidify that structure. The next document, and it's in the next slide, slide six, is what's called the Federal Resource Allocation Criteria Policy. This policy was issued by the Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment, vetted through the White House policy process and through the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And this laid out a framework by which the federal government would engage with fusion centers. It kind of set that level of expectation and a level of prioritization for what we would engage with the fusion centers, realizing that there's limited resources out there. The other important piece of this policy is that it actually delineated three categories, if you will, of partnership across the country. You've got a primary fusion center in each state. That's the primary state center that is the primary focal point. Most states only have one fusion center, so that's easy. Some states that have decided to structure themselves with multiple fusion centers or on a regional approach, that's what we call a recognized fusion center. And so it's kind of the urban area centers. But what this policy laid out is that it clearly delineated that the prioritization for resources would go to that state center. And again, if we don't have people or systems to push out to every fusion center out there, this is what draws that line in the sand and helps us prioritize where we're going to provide those resources. Next slide. So what are those resources? The resources folks most often hear about are our personnel and the systems that we push out to the fusion centers. Right now, we have regional directors across the country that manage their individual regions, and we've attempted to have intelligence officers located in all the fusion centers. They're not in all of them right now, but they are in the vast majority of the fusion centers across the country. Those intel officers play a variety of roles that are outlined in legislation to include liaison responsibilities, facilitation of training, facilitating that fusion center essentially implement the intelligence cycle. So they have a wide range of responsibilities that, again, are tailored for that jurisdiction. We also have a handful of reports officers and intelligence analysts that are also deployed across the country. The reports officers are focused on the collection of information and sharing it with the federal partners in the intel community. And then analysts are obviously focused on the development of products jointly with our state and local partners. And then we also have Homeland Secure Data Network, HSDN terminals, that have been pushed out again to the vast majority of the fusion centers. And these are the systems that provide that secret connectivity to our state and local partners so that they can access and share products at that secret level. Next slide. Governance. Governance is another essential element of how we manage this relationship, essentially as the steward of working on behalf of the federal government to engage and support fusion centers. What I wanted to note is that there's two core governance structures that we have to execute this engagement. The first is through the IPC process, which is the Interagency Policy Committee process managed through the White House, where we are able to engage all of our federal partners. That group is co-chaired by the FBI and our office, INA at DHS, and essentially has all the appropriate partners from the federal level around the table, whether you're talking DEA, Health and Human Services, the host of partners, where we have a forum to be able to share information on what are the initiatives we're pursuing for the coming year. We actually develop an annual work plan that lays out what are the initiatives we want to achieve, the milestones, and then the deliverables that are going to result from it. And it really gives a great forum to ensure that all the federal partners are engaged. Additionally, one of the issues that we heard from our state and local partners is that they were sick and tired of getting hit up by all the federal departments for data calls and for surveys and assessments and all these host of outreach activities. This has provided a forum where we have a one-stop shop to be able to really speak with one voice on behalf of the federal government and consolidate all of that input through one mechanism, obviously releasing that burden that's on some of the fusion centers. Within DHS, we've also structured a parallel group that governs kind of the same approach, but for DHS internally. So all the DHS components, ICE, CBP, Coast Guard, can engage in the exact same manner and, again, speak with one voice. And if there's any questions, please feel free to throw them out as we're going through. So the next slide is slide 9, and this is really what's become our bread and butter with managing and evaluating the maturity of this national network that we've all collectively invested in over the past decade. We want to start to see what is that return on investment, what is the value that we're getting collectively across the country. And so that has been executed through the Fusion Center Performance Program. This program has several elements to it, but the one that is most familiar with folks is an annual assessment process. This assessment process actually goes out and evaluates the fusion centers for two core elements. It evaluates their capabilities, and it also evaluates the performance, and I'll get into that a little bit more. But it is our data collection mechanism to really look at what is the maturity of the fusion centers, what is the return on investment that we're getting. And not only does it look at their capabilities, we actually dive into their personnel. What are the standards their personnel are trained to? Have they taken the training courses that meet the required standards? Do they have access to the security clearances? It even gets into their budget. We actually collect information from all the fusion centers on what their budget looks like, what percentages of the budget are state and local dollars, what percentage are grant funds. So we really dive into and collect a ton of data from them. The next slide is the one I think I'll touch on quite a bit here. So this program, this gives you a perspective of where the program has grown over the past several years. When this effort originally rolled out in 2010, it was very focused on capability. The way I describe it, though, is capability is great. You can have all the capability in the world, but capability can sit on a shelf, and you don't necessarily do anything with it. So as the program has matured, we've slowly added performance measures to actually see what is that return on investment. In 2012, we kicked off 5 initial performance measures that we collect data on. In 2013, that number went up to 34 performance measures, and we are hoping in the coming year or two to execute all the performance measures that we have, which are 45. And that, is really what gives us that unique perspective on, comparing the capabilities and what it's actually resulting in. Just a quick example that I'll give on some of the performance measures that we have. We look at things like how many of the SAR that the Fusion Center have processed are actually tied to an FBI investigation. Well, that starts to show you, you know, what is the result from some of the analysis and the intake mechanisms they have, and what is it resulting in supporting the federal government. That's just one example. A couple other ones I'll touch on, specifically related to security, and great kudos to Charlie and his team and Ken Polk at INA for helping us build this out. But we look at the percentage of Fusion Centers that have addressed corrective actions that were identified in their security compliance review. So again, it's tying in, you know, they're getting these reviews done, but what are they actually doing to address any deficiencies or any issues? And so we actually collect that data and measure that as part of their performance. Next slide. The capability measures, just so folks have an awareness, are structured around the intelligence cycle. We've, for the purposes of the assessment, broken it down to four critical operational capabilities: its ability to receive information, analyze it, disseminate it, and then gather and collect against it. The enabling capabilities, which are privacy protections, long-term sustainment, communications and outreach, and security. And again, a couple of the security data elements that we collect are things like, does a Fusion Center have a plan or SOP for how they're going to execute their security efforts? Do they have access to CVS that we just spoke of? Do they train their staff on those policies and those different accesses? And then also, do they have a security liaison officer? Right now, we are sitting, as Charlie noted earlier, at 76 of the 78 Fusion Centers have a designated security officer. The challenge that we've dealt with over the past several years has been turnover. And that's a constant challenge. I don't think that's going to go away. It has stabilized quite a bit, but it is something we are very cognizant of, because that in turn drives our future planning and decisions when it comes to training programs and what we need to have available to ensure these folks are appropriately trained and have access to what they need. Slide 12. So what results from all this data that's collected? A couple things. We issue every fall an individual Fusion Center report, and that basically reports back to the Fusion Center exactly where they are at in achieving these capabilities and performance. And that report goes just to the Fusion Center and to the folks in their AORs, like the Homeland Security Advisor. Additionally, we issue a final report that basically is the summation for the whole network performance for that entire performance cycle. It doesn't call out individual Fusion Centers by name. It strictly looks at the aggregate. The 2013 report was actually released yesterday, so it'll be on our website, I hope, by the end of today. So that's a publicly available document. We're happy to share it with this group as well, if they have an interest in looking through that. And then the final item that we use from this assessment process is what we call tailored reports. We will dig through the data and develop a tailored report for any of the agencies that want to request it. So the example I would use is Health and Human Services has a keen interest of what Fusion Centers are engaged in, you know, public health related activities or have public health personnel working in the Fusion Centers. We'll run a tailored report for them. You know, similar reports can be run for DEA and other federal partners. So that's something that we do go through the data and provide those tailored reports. Next slide, slide 13. And I'll touch on these last two pretty quickly so we can get into any questions folks might have. But this process is intimately tied to the FEMA grants process. We have a great relationship with FEMA that has been cultivated over the past 5 years, where the results from this assessment process are directly used to inform their grant request. And as they go through and spend the money on the different projects that they've proposed, they actually track you know, how the money has been spent and if it's actually been spent to address the capabilities that have been identified through the assessment process. So we actually have a continuous process here where we can look at whether the money and the grant funds are actually addressing the capability gaps identified through the assessment. Something else that's been interesting, just a statistic over the past several years, we do collect the amount of money that the Fusion Centers operate against and how much of that is a grant-funded element. The grant funding piece has dropped significantly over the past several years. And you often see numbers about how many, you know, hundreds of millions fund this network. When you actually look at the operating costs of the network, you're only sitting around 20% that comes from the grants that are offered through FEMA. Closer to 60% of that is directly from the state and local pots. And then the remaining elements that support the network are the what we call direct federal expenditures, so things like our personnel that are sitting out there, the training programs we run. But the key is that the grants actually play a very small portion of that overall support for the national network. The next slide is slide 14. And this is, how is this data used? How is the assessment data used to inform our collective investment and resource allocation? Well, we use all that data to essentially identify where there are weak spots, where there are capabilities across the network. And then, it informs our planning activities to develop resources to support the fusion centers. There's a list of the resources on this page. I won't go into all of them, but it's everything from publishing best practices and lessons learned from the fusion centers. We develop guidebooks and templates to help them standardize their processes as a network across all the fusion centers, and then a host of training and education services that are provided to train analysts, to train directors, and then security officers are one of the core areas that we focus on for training. Generally speaking, that is done through an annual security liaison workshop where we actually bring all the security officers from all the fusion centers together for a robust 3-day training to keep them up to speed on any changes that are occurring within this landscape. And we also bring back new security officers to DHS for a robust 2-day training as well. We don't want to wait a full year cycle if they've just gotten on board, so we'll actually bring them back for an on-site hands-on training at DHS headquarters. So that's a pretty quick run-through of a lot of efforts that we're engaged in, and hopefully it might have answered some of your questions, but I would certainly like to, open it up if there's any questions folks have that I didn't address.
And certainly also for the folks on the phone, please join in. Kevin, the one question that I had, I'll say go back to the point about the interest in information sharing measures, evidence that security is not, one way to put it is just, If we feel like security is not a barrier to sharing, can we prove that it's not? And if it is, can we identify those things and work on getting them out of the way? In your performance measures, you mentioned there's 50-some mm-hmm. target performance measures. Can any of them be sort of tagged with this attribute about getting at the security sharing mix? And how does that bear out in reporting?
I think you bring up a great point because performance metrics, generally speaking, is a very challenging thing to deal with.
Absolutely.
And it's even more challenging when you're dealing with the prevention mission area and the intelligence cycle. You often don't have outcomes that are readily accessible or known immediately. And so that's one of the challenges that we've dealt with the performance measures. And a lot of them you will find become proxy measures that we use to determine an outcome. And a great example I would use is a relationship that we have developed with the National Governors Association. We will in turn go out to some of the core customers. They actually run a survey for us where they look at the Homeland Security advisors, police chiefs, state colonels. We're expanding it this year to emergency management directors. And we actually pulse and survey some of those customers to identify whether they're getting the information they need in a timely manner, an accurate manner, and is it useful. So I think there's some of those proxies to determine whether the information is actually getting to the customer that it's intended to get to. And that's been very valuable, but I would certainly offer up, as this body and the role that you all play, I would love to be able to share that report that we just released with you. It has all the performance measures in there and get your thoughts and input of, are there additional opportunities to get some of the data to answer some of these questions or additional performance measures?
Right, because sometimes there's a gap in expectation between what is a promised performance, right? And so if you're not asking the right question, you're not going to discover that there are unmet expectations, right? And so and that sort of a feels like metric, mm-hmm. rather than, yes, I have the capability to get all my people logged on, they log on and they see what they see, are they satisfied? Are they expecting that there's something else there? Are they frustrated by some administrative or security issue that's keeping them from getting something that they want? And is that something they want, something they should want within this? I mean, that's a really complex thing, but I think in the area of information sharing, that tends to be what we hear about. We are equally interested in the infrastructure, the turnover in training, the turnover in security liaisons, the attention to training them. I think that's great. The idea of having the annual conference, I know that has been a very popular thing among attendees.
And the fact that those attendees turn over and you can bring them back, you can bring the new folks in, I think that's, you know, all of those are great measures of the infrastructure. But, you know, just some thoughts about that. And I think I'd be happy to take a look at those things and just give additional thought to that. I'm not trying to stir a pot that doesn't need to be stirred, but there's a very dispersed program like this, it's sometimes hard to get a finger on the pulse of those little bothersome things that just don't rise to attention. And if we can ask that question from time to time and make sure that everybody's, you know, either getting what they need or getting an opportunity to give voice to their concerns, then I think that's the most that we could do.
I would just chime in, I could not agree more. And that's the exact transition that we're trying to undertake from the capability to performance. And you know, the other thing I would just offer up with the performance measures, some of that data is collected from the fusion centers, but a lot of it is actually not collected from the fusion centers. We need independent sources, whether it's, you know, the FBI, DHS, the stakeholders, and that's where you're really going to get that other perspective of, is this working?
Terrific, thanks very much. Other questions or comments?
I have a question.
Yeah?
Yes, Omero with ISU. On slide 3, you mentioned, this is from a research curiosity. On slide 3, you mentioned that the Fusion Center's adopted off-crimes approach. Now, to what extent then is the, say, DEA or FBI or ATF involved with Fusion Centers to counter drug trafficking or, say, the illegal activities of militias or the manufacturing of methamphetamines in these rural areas? So is there an extent where they're working with other federal entities?
Absolutely. And so that, I'll give you, might be a little bit of a long-winded response, but the level of which the fusion centers are engaged in what we call this all crimes area does range. Some fusion centers are co-located with HIDAs or other task forces or entities looking at you know, particular issues. But what we actually do, and there's a couple answers to address your question, we also conduct every year as part of this assessment process what's called a federal cost inventory, where we actually go to all the federal agencies and departments and look at what their investment is in fusion centers and what personnel they have in fusion centers. And so we collect information from DEA and all these other partners looking at what fusion centers do they have personnel assigned to or working in and what are the topic areas that they're working on. So that's one part of it. But we also work with the fusion centers to actually break down what does their mission set look like. So I could tell you if, you know, X percentage of fusion centers have, you know, drugs within their mission set, and those fusion centers are working with DEA or the HIDA in their AOR. So we actually do break that down by all the fusion centers to look at what their mission encompasses and to what level of engagement they have. And I'll tell you, this past year especially, there's been a huge emphasis based on a GAO report that came out about a year and a half, 2 years ago, looking at what does that field level engagement look like. Because we certainly don't want fusion centers, we want to encourage them not to duplicate or replicate activities that are going on from federal partners or other task forces. And so if they, you know, work together with those folks, obviously it's going to be a lot more bang for our buck. So we're really encouraging and collecting a lot of data on what does that field level information sharing and engagement look like. But to answer the question, yeah, we can break down most of that data, both from the federal information we receive and the fusion center information, if there's any specifics folks were interested in.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. In you know, going through your presentation, there seems to be a significant lack of the letters PS in any of this. I don't see where the private sector either benefits from this or participates in this. It all drives down to local law enforcement or in some cases state law enforcement, and I don't see the linkage back into the private sector. So are there any metrics to try to or possibly being developed that could kind of determine from a performance perspective what kind of private sector participation and involvement is occurring?
Yeah, and absolutely. And we do collect quite a bit of information on looking at the fusion centers to see which ones are engaged with private sector. And you know, the honest truth is some of them are more engaged than others. Some of the centers are very engaged with their private sector partners, and others have limited their engagement. And that does range. In some cases, it's based on some of their local laws that they believe do not allow them to share some of this information. But when we dig into it, a lot of times that isn't necessarily the case. There's a hesitancy there. What we've actually done is we have a couple programs that we actually provide out to fusion centers. We call them technical assistance programs. to basically help educate them and help them build out some of those outreach activities. The way we go about it, though, is we think it's more effective to have a grassroots or peer-based approach to doing that rather than the feds coming in to tell them to do that, which we can't do in some cases. And so what we'll do is we'll identify a fusion center that's got a really robust private sector outreach program or engagement program, and we'll basically bring that center in to mentor them and you know, show them how to build this program out. So we have some of those services. But I think to answer your question on the assessment and the metrics, I think we collect quite a bit of capability-related data to whether they engage with private sectors. I will say from the performance metrics side, nothing is jumping to me right now that I recall those measures that are specifically focused on that. But I think that's something we could certainly pursue and look at how we can get feedback, you know, from some of those customers on what the engagement looks like. One thing I will say that's been a challenge, and we've been trying to pursue this over the past year, is with the National Council of ISACs, because the ISACs approached us and said, hey, we want to figure out how to build out this relationship. Well, the challenge there is you've got 78 centers that are geographically based. You've got, you know, was it about a dozen ISACs that are sector based. And so we didn't want a structure to be in place where there was a lot of white noise, where you got individual ISACs communicating with 78 centers. You know, and I could see some of the centers just turning that off. And so we're looking and have been working with them to do an enterprise-wide approach to that. So we're actually piloting some efforts right now to actually take the Fusion Center products and have them cross-shared with private sector partners through some of the HISN platforms. So we're looking at a couple efforts to do that from an enterprise standpoint that we think will be more palatable, at least for an initial go at this. So I think there's quite a bit underway, but I would certainly say that is one of our areas for improvement.
Is there a center point for that effort, for coordinating that effort, that maybe we could do some follow-up with?
Yeah. The person actually doing the pilot right now works for me, and they're actually detailed to the NIC, the National Infrastructure Coordinating Council. Yeah. So we have the right players, we believe, involved. But yeah, the person on my staff is the one that's actually working that pilot.
Is it as simple, this is a question I guess mm-hmm. for both of you, if there's a disconnect here, is it as simple that, and looking at this briefing, again, this is not the totality of activity, this is just, that's very much intelligence and law enforcement focused, where many of the private sector engagements are critical infrastructure centric and are going to fall along the split that you, mm-hmm. Organizational split that you identify, ISACs versus the Fusion Center construct. So if there's a way, if that's a legitimate gap, and I hear Clyde saying, expressing some concern that it is, plugging this group more into that discussion, or representatives who are, you know, interested in or involved more on the ISAC side into that discussion, maybe we can build the bridge, you know, through this dialogue.
Absolutely, I think that's a great opportunity, and you know, I'll tell you, the best examples too have come from some of the fusion centers themselves that have done some innovative approaches to engaging the private sector folks. So yeah, I think we would absolutely welcome that.
Absolutely. You certainly got. I mean, I think trying to link up with the ISACs and figure out how to make that work is definitely a mm-hmm. step in the right direction. I would also suggest that you may want to loop in with the DSAC, which is FBI sponsored, and they've now got a former private sector guy, Brad Brecky, that's now been hired by the Bureau to try to get that a little more active, and so that might be another angle there. But at the end of the day, the fusion centers have to understand that one of their customers is, in fact, the private sector in their respective geographical organizations, and until they buy into that, there's always going to be that gap. If they're just feeding the cops, it may or may not be getting to the private sector.
No, there's no argument here. We completely agree with that. And you know, the reality is that the challenge is that most of these entities grew out of a law enforcement organization, a law enforcement culture, and you know, what you just described is some of the same challenges we've had over the years with getting public health or getting fire, getting some of the other non-law enforcement partners engaged in these efforts, because they bring a wealth of knowledge, experience, data, and expertise that the law enforcement organizations aren't going to have necessarily on their own. And so we completely concur with that. And a great point on the DSAC, we actually do have someone there, and we're actually working something with them right now, getting DSAC information to the fusion centers and trying to reverse engineer that approach as well. Okay. So, yeah.
All right. Well, maybe, even going back to this governance model, maybe there needs to be some kind of figure out a way to plug in a private sector representation in that as well. So
that's a great point. That's something we have not pursued. We had to jump through quite a few hoops to actually get a state and local representative on that. But I, being a you know, federal governance, and they have to be in an advisory role, but I don't see why we couldn't do something similar for the private sector. So we'll take that for action.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Terrific. Other questions for Kevin?
Really do appreciate your briefing. I think it's great to see all of this in one package. As you said, it's very broad, but it's also got real depth to it, and you understand what the challenges are for running that kind of program and nationwide. The agenda calls for me to turn it back to you, Charlie, but did you run through all your stuff at the front end?
No.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, terrific. Yeah. Let me turn it back over to you.
Okay. And I'm going to talk about some of the activities we're doing that I've spoken about before, but just to give an update on it, and some of it will touch upon a little bit of what Kevin's talked about. And I know there's some new members, but I don't want to give a long presentation. We've got a security compliance review program. We've stood it up a couple of years ago. It's based on some sound security checklists that are based on our implementing directive and other executive orders. And I just wanted to come up on the numbers. Kevin referred to the fact that there's a total of 78 fusion centers, 53 of them are primary centers. We did one SCR in fiscal year 2012, but in 13 and 14, we've done a, in 2013, we did 21 SCRs. This year, by the end of the year, the fiscal year, we expect to do 19. The bottom line is, in about 2 years, we've done 41 security compliance reviews. So that puts us on kind of a four-year plan to get to 80. And it is pretty much, we're at the limit. We 1 year we did 22, but based on the staffing, getting people out to the centers, doing the compliance review, getting back, writing reports, resolving the issues, about 20 plus is about what we can handle with our current staffing. So that puts us at about 4 years where we can complete a cycle and then start back with the fusion centers. We've got two SCRs going on this week in Wisconsin. I have to put my glasses on to tell you the Wisconsin Statewide Information Center and the Southeastern Wisconsin Threat Analysis Center. Kevin mentioned there's a metric that's kept by the Fusion Center office that has to do with required actions. When we do SCRs, we have two sets of findings. One are required actions, which are based on policy. There's something that's not being done that we can cite policy that needs to be done, whether it's maintaining training records, doing the alarm monitoring, which we require on a monthly basis. And then there's recommended actions where we don't tell them that they must do something, but we recommend that they might consider doing something that would improve the program. The ones we really track are the required actions. So there's a metric with the Fusion Center Program Office. I work within management and DHS, and we have the same metric that we're following in management to make sure we follow up on the required actions. What I can tell you about the Security Compliance Review Program is that we have never found a Fusion Center that we felt the classified information was at risk. I mean, we found some that have three or four required actions because they were a lack of awareness or knowledge. We've had others that have absolutely zero required actions. They're doing everything they're supposed to be doing. And a lot of this is based upon the training that's being provided to the security liaisons. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, and Kevin alluded to it. So we feel pretty good about the program. I mean, we would like to be able to visit 78 fusion centers in 3 years instead of four. The programs are being run pretty well, and we're fairly happy with it. The other trips we do, and this is just more of as an aside, we also go out and certify the rooms that sometimes a fusion center will relocate, thus they need another certified room to manage the HSDN systems. And so there's about 4 to 6 trips that have to do with pre-construction surveys and that kind of thing. And most of the fusion centers are up with secure rooms. We're now beginning to get to the territories, which I guess were put off for obvious reasons. They weren't, I guess, the main focus at the initial But Guam is going to get a fusion center with a secure room, and working with Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. And some of those locations are challenges because of their remoteness, alarm monitoring and things of that sort. But so other than this compliance review, we do another about 5-6 trips a year to support the deployment of HSDN. That's pretty much the update for the compliance review. Kevin referred to the training of the security liaisons and the Office of Intelligence and Analysis and their security function, really coordinated and sponsored and largely funded the most recent security liaison workshop, and that took place in June in Albuquerque. It's the third one that has occurred. The other two were, the first one was in Oklahoma City, and the second one is in San Antonio, Texas. What we're finding is, you know, the initial ones were, we were the federals talking to the state and locals. This is what you need to do, this is what you need to understand, this is the information you need to learn. We're finding from the surveys and that kind of thing that our audience is more sophisticated. So this last go-round for the security liaison workshop, we offered about, I think about 13 presentations, but they were offered multiple times to have breakout sessions so that we'd only have maybe 11 to 15 people in a room. And the idea was to try during those briefings to stop, you know, we'd talk about compliance reviews, and then the second half of the training was to get their input. Tell us what you're doing, tell us what's wrong, tell us what's right. And that was the attempt in all the presentations, to get more interaction, because we do have security liaisons now who've been doing this job for 3-4 years, and they don't want to be told how to fill out a checklist that they've been filling out for the last 3 years. So I think that approach works to get the classroom sizes smaller, to get more interaction. I think approximately 75 liaisons came, and it's a 2.5-day training event. I don't want to read through all the presentations, but Tricia Prasnikar, Carol Moorhunt came out from the OPM and did a CVS briefing. The FBI was represented. They did a couple of briefings, one on cybersecurity, which was very well received. And then we did the normal briefings with the change-up. We had counterintelligence. We did briefings on foreign access management, which I'll refer to a little bit later. The need to vet foreign visitors to fusion centers to try and get them incorporated into a federal process to give them a heads up if there's someone coming that they should be aware of. And then the normal clearance adjudication, OPSEC, counterintelligence briefings were provided to them this year. So what's in the works, and it's not a done deal by any means, but there's a desire, you know, we've got the fusion center piece down, but there's other state and local players that we're not interacting with as fully, and one of those is the governor's office and the Homeland Security Advisor's office, and they certainly don't have the same classified footprint that a fusion center has, but they have roles to play in this. The governor's office, the Homeland Security Advisor, actually nominates and is part of the clearance vetting process for state and locals. In many of those locations, they do store classified, and they certainly have access to ComSec. So there's a desire to bring them into the security liaison workshop training. I mean, it's just in the planning stages right now to see if we can't design curriculum that would fit their needs, maybe for a one-day part of it. More work needs to be done on that. And apart from that, my office wants to begin to work with Intergovernmental Affairs, Elena is here, to begin to invite them into our HISN websites and to begin to do webinars with their security point of contacts. So it's work that needs to be done. I'm waiting for the election where there's going to be a turnover. And that is another big challenge with the Homeland Security Office, the governor's offices, the personnel changeovers there that are somewhat dictated by elections. But Anyway, that's a new initiative that we hope to have progress and be able to report back on. I want to talk a little bit more about security liaison training that is apart from the workshop, and Kevin also alluded to that. We do a monthly webinar. I say monthly, it probably averages about 10, 8, 9 times a year, where we, under the implementing directive, security liaisons are required to be trained within 60 days. Well, we can't just magically train them, but we can at least do a monthly webinar with the newly appointed liaisons. And they can attend that as often every month if they want. And that at least establishes relationships with us and with the INA security office so that we both participate and do the webinar, and they're not just out there appointed without any knowledge. And then, as Kevin mentioned, there's the quarterly training that's funded by INA, in which I think it's about 5 people a quarter are invited, liaisons, and they come to headquarters for a couple of days of training. And then there's the more or less annual. I mean, it's taking about more like 15, 16 months, but the big training workshop. So we have several outreaches to try and ensure that we've got relationships with and training is being provided. And that segues kind of into the other thing is our Homeland Security, the HISA network. And all the liaisons that attended the conference have an account, and they can sign in to the Homeland Security Information Network, the Security Administration portal. We're still looking at building that portal to be more robust, but we have over 100 policy documents. We have an area where liaisons can come in and have a chat room. Other cleared people are able to be a part of the overall portal. But to be honest, we only have about 150 members in that portal. We have a couple of pilots where we present training, but it's a challenge. DHS has cleared about 2,000 private sector people and about 5,000 state and local. So we utilize the security liaisons to train the Fusion Center personnel. Have challenges to get the training to all these other dispersed folks. We've looked at the HISN website as a means to do that. We're working with NPPD and DHS has a lot of the private sector clearances to figure out ways that we can deliver private sector security training. And I'm going to meet with them in August. They actually had some people who manage the HISN website and have a little more expertise than I do, but there's a rather than force people to set up a HISN account in which they have to go through a lot of processes and procedures, there are mechanisms to give them a one-time sign-on to invite them to the security training. They go to what's called Adobe Connect within HISN. They take the training, a record is captured of the training, and
just knowing all this facts and then email them back.
Yeah, and they don't have to go through all this membership paperwork and get remember all this stuff. And then a year later, we say, well, you need to reactivate your HISN account. You need to fill out this form. So we're looking at ways to try and figure out how to crack the training. I mean, the liaisons are a force multiplier for us. I mean, we intend to work with the Homeland Security offices and train their folks. But getting the training out to all these clearance holders is still going to be a big challenge. And I mentioned foreign access management. That's something that Intergovernmental Affairs is working with a section in my office. That's just one piece of kind of security-related training that, we work with the feds when they have foreign visitors coming to their facilities. And we had a briefing here, a previous meeting from the individual on that. But how do we get the Fusion Centers integrated to it? And how do we get that training out there regarding it so they know what they need to do? Insider Threat is another program. It's not a program that I particularly run, but how do we connect the information and the training to the Fusion Centers on that? So I would say the biggest challenge that we have, we've made a lot of progress, is getting the training to the right people and figuring out how to do that in a smooth and functional way. And I'll take any help or ideas that people have. But think I covered most of it. By the way, on our HISN site, we do post the PAC minutes, and we post the members up there in addition to other reference library information. I think that pretty much covers my overview.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Any questions for Charlie?
I have a question. You mentioned the training and the compliance reviews, and you talk about classified information, but do you go into anything about the controlled unclassified information, whether it's SBU, FOUO, LES? Because that's where I personally see more of the things ending up in the media.
Well, we train FOUO in accordance with DHS policy. The thing is that controlled unclassified information is a work in progress. So yes, once we get it more completely formalized and the training protocols, we will be giving that training. It'll be posted to the HISN sites. We'll train the security liaisons on it. Where we are now is that FBI has some policies regarding how they handle sensitive information. So what our big, fallback statement to the fusion centers is, this is DHS policy governing DHS information. And when you deal with an FBI document, or you're dealing with a Department of Energy document, you really need to go to the originating office to get the specific guidance. But yes, once CUI gets more fully formalized and the training protocols are out, then CUI will be the security liaison will be trained in CUI, and we'll, just as we have the other people in my office will be dealing with the federal side and DHS, we'll work to get out the products.
So do you talk about unclassified outside of FOUO? I mean, because it's unclassified doesn't mean it should be handed out at their, church on Sunday. Right. So, you cover that kind of... I know the OPSEC training is really good. I've been through some of that with DHS, so...
We train them on sensitive unclassified.
Okay, thank you.
And a lot of the Homeland Security advisors and other state and local officials in these Homeland Security positions, a lot of them are retired federal employees or military, so they understand the sensitivities of this.
Well, and I would just offer up too, I think a lot of this is law enforcement sensitive information, especially when you're at the state and local level, that's tactical or operational in nature, and so it involves a lot of their cases and ongoing efforts at the local level too. So I think they're keenly aware and protective of that type of information.
Just wondering why I keep seeing it in the news.
So,
is there a question from online?
Yeah, this is Chris Pickering from Missouri. I'm having a hard time hearing comments. If somebody could speak up or speak into that microphone.
Hey, Chris, this is Elena. I was just saying that the Homeland Security advisors and other state and local officials in your capacity understand the sensitivities of unclassified information that's still marked FOUO. So it's not necessarily the state and locals that are putting this information into the press. I mean, I think also on the federal side, there's a lot of federal officials that receive this information. So I wouldn't want to say it's or frame it that it's the state and locals that are putting this out there.
Just asking about the training and the compliance reviews.
I appreciate that advocacy, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person, which would make this easier. I will next time. Thanks for clearing it up.
Yep, good. Let me just give we briefed this group, I think, in the last meeting or a previous meeting on the CUI program at large. I'll give a brief update and then a promise here between now and the next meeting. Currently, the CUI program, which ISU also has responsibility for putting into place, is at a stage in the regulatory process where a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is a draft federal regulation, is in the executive branch interagency review process. So federal agencies are asked by OMB to provide comments on the draft rule as written. Those comments come back to us here in ISU for resolution, adjustments to the draft, and then a new draft to be produced. We received about a month ago 333 valuable comments from that process, and we are in the process of revising the draft rule to reflect the changes that, much of it is clarification and I'll just say the shape of the rule, the proper placement of guidance in the federal regulatory scheme, rather than the substance of how you protect these things and
how you mark them. So what I expect is that we will put the next draft of the rule back out through another round of government interagency, finalize it, and the stage after that is that it goes in the Federal Register and for public review and comment. And we will then do a comment resolution on that. Timeline-wise, we would expect that phase will happen in the late fall. So between this meeting and the next meeting, I would hope that we would have a draft rule out in the Federal Register. And when we get to that point, we will let all our email stakeholders know that that is the case and provide a copy of the rule and a pointer to where anybody can put comments in through the public review and comment process. There's no objection to taking a look at the draft rule if you have an interest in it now. It's just from a version control standpoint, it's going to change a lot between its current version and the version that will eventually go out for public comment. So I would just have everybody tune in to that's where we are in the process. The slow and arduous and painful but necessary process of federal rulemaking will probably produce a final rule in the spring of next year. And when we reach that day that it's signed out of the Federal Register as a rule, we call that day zero of the program. There's time period that will likely be as much as a year for agencies to begin implementation of that. During that year, after the rule is issued, will be the time when agencies start communicating the fact of changes to come to procedures like the ones we were just talking about here. How is it that law enforcement sensitive information that exists in a certain protection and marking scheme, how will that be carried over into a, you know, equivalent protection and marking scheme that is consistent across other types of information? Critical infrastructure information, health and safety information, all manner of topics that fall into this sensitive and classified. So we will certainly talk about this topic again in this body, and the information sharing equities in the state, local, tribal stakeholders will certainly be affected. And as Charlie says, as soon as it's the appropriate time in the sequence, training will be provided, and mm-hmm. and we'll have all of the benefits of implementation, which is always smooth, seamless, and without incident. And we've thought of everything in advance by writing the rule. So we'll look forward to everyone's comments and what we make a better rule by getting everybody's comments and concern as quickly as possible into the process. So that's briefly where we are with CUI, and a promise that when it gets notice for public comment, we'll let all the stakeholders know and invite participation.
Can I just ask a quick question? The vetting of foreign visitors to your fusion centers, is that done like it is done on the federal level through DHS security? It's a big issue for the federal partners as well, so I'm just curious, do you know?
Well, the process now is that the fusion centers identify that the visitors are coming to INA. INA sends over the data to an activity within the Office of Security, the DHS Office of Security. I'm not real familiar, but then they reach out to the FBI, they reach out to other federal and access databases that provide them with the information, and they provide that back to INA, and it's more to give, at least this is my opinion, give fair warning of what you're up against. It's not to tell them you can't have a visitor, but it's to tell them that if there's a particular visitor they should be concerned about, that they get that information before the visit, and then they can make their own decision. So,
Charlie, I would just offer up too that the vast majority of what we've seen too are those visits actually come through a DHS or FBI headquarters element, and then we will facilitate the outreach to the fusion center to set that up. So a lot of them are actually coming to the headquarters first before going directly to the fusion center. So that obviously helps with that situation quite a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the challenge for, I know this, these guys in my office, is getting the data in time,
right,
and getting enough specifics on the person, the individual, that they can identify who he is and, or who she is. And, but the desire is to assist the fusion centers with the same service that we provide to the at DHS.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions for Charlie? All right, that's our last scheduled agenda item. I would like to ask, or otherwise share, Clyde, if you have any other items that you'd like to share or discuss before we go. And we'll also ask everyone in the room and on the phone to raise your hand or raise your voice if there's an item you'd like to raise or a question you'd like to ask.
Well, thanks. Despite me really racking my brain to come up with something, I'm pretty dry right now for a change, so appreciate the opportunity.
No, terrific. Thank you. Anyone on the phone? Okay, so before we close it up, let me say a few things about the next meeting. Actually, the next two meetings have found a place on the calendar, so you will get notice of this in the usual manner, but January 28th, 2015, oh my gosh, 2015, and July 22nd of next year will be our two meeting dates. If there are items, programs, questions that you'd like raised in these sessions, please let us know, and we will investigate the best way to put that item on the agenda. Please also look for the minutes of this meeting that will get posted. And we thank everybody for coming. And this meeting is now adjourned.